Hello, and welcome to episode 44 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I am joined by Taylor Molly. As I've talked to people about Taylor Molly, they usually reply, "Who's that?" Then I say, "Have you heard of What Teachers Make?" And they go, "Oh yeah, yeah, I know that." So I think the best way to intro this episode is to open with Taylor himself performing that, and then we're just going to go straight into the interview, and I'll talk to you all on the end.
He says the problem with teachers is, what's a kid gonna learn from someone who decided that his best option in life was to become a teacher? He reminds the other dinner guests that, you know, it's true what they say about teachers. Those who can, do. And those who can't, teach. I decide to bite my tongue instead of his. And resist the urge to remind the other dinner guests that it's also true what they say about lawyers, because we're eating, after all. And this is supposed to be polite conversation. I mean, you're a teacher, Taylor. Come on, be honest. What do you make? And I wish he hadn't done that. Asked me to be honest. Because, you see, I have this little policy in my classroom about honesty and ass-kicking, which is, if you ask for it, then I have to let you have it. You want to know what I make? I make kids work harder than they ever thought they could. I can make a C-plus feel like a Congressional Medal of Honor, and I can make an A-minus feel like a slap in the face. How dare you waste my time with anything less than your very best? I make kids sit through 40 minutes of study hall in absolute silence. No, you may not work in groups. No, you cannot ask me a question, so put your hand down. Why won't I let you go to the bathroom? Because you're bored, and you don't really have to go to the bathroom, do you? I make parents tremble in fear when I call home at around dinner time. Hi, this is Mr. Molly. I hope I haven't called at a bad time. I just wanted to talk to you about something that your son said today to the biggest bully in the class. He said, "Leave that kid alone. I still cry sometimes, don't you?" And it was the noblest act of courage that I have ever seen. I make parents see their children for who they are and who they can be. You want to know what I make? I make kids wonder. I make them question. I make them criticize. I make them apologize and mean it. I make them write, and then I make them read. I make them spell. Definitely beautiful. Definitely beautiful. Definitely beautiful, definitely beautiful, until they will never misspell either one of those words again. I make them show all their work in math class and then hide it on their final drafts in English. I make them realize that if you've got this, then you follow this. And if somebody ever tries to judge you based on what you make, you give them this. Here, let me break it down for you so you know what I say is true. I make a difference. Now, what about you?
All right, so the intro is a little bit different this time because I'm nerding out a little bit. I'm geeking out. I'm trying not to be too fanboy because you just heard the amazing What Teachers Make, which is my go-to inspiration for all teachers. It is probably the best thing to pump up and feel good about our profession, in my opinion. And I am beyond amazed to be able to say that I'm actually talking to Taylor Molly himself tonight. Hey, Taylor, how's it going?
It is going well, Brad. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I'm trying to like keep cool about this. Like, I don't know if you've ever had this experience before, but I'm not good at it. I'm not good at like talking to someone who I respect and admire so much. So, all right.
You're doing fine. You're doing fine so far. Yeah.
I'm going to try to like hone my high school students and just be apathetic. Like, oh, it's no big deal. I don't really care. Taylor, for my audience who has not heard of you or doesn't know your work beyond that poem, can you maybe give us a little intro to who you are and what you do?
I am a 12th generation resident of New York City, although it was called New Amsterdam when my first ancestors got here. Both of my parents were born and raised in Manhattan, as were all four of my grandparents. So I'm Dutch. I am of Dutch ancestry, although the name Molly comes from Belgium. And my father was a poet, was an occasional poet. He read poems at special occasions, like my mother's 50th birthday party and his parents' 50th wedding anniversary. And had he lived to see me get married, I'm sure he would have had a poem for my wedding. My mother was Jane Lawrence Molly. She wrote children's books. She won a National Book Award in 1980 about a class that was taught at my all-boys school in Manhattan in baby care. And they would bring in on Tuesdays, the nurse practitioner who taught the class would say, all right, this is how you hold a baby. This is what you do if a baby starts to choke and blah, blah, blah. And they would sort of prep the boys for what they were. And these were fifth and sixth grade boys. And they would prep the boys for what they were going to be doing on Thursday when new mothers would bring in actual babies for the boys to practice, changing them, bathing them, feeding them. And I remember I was already in like seventh or eighth grade when my mother was writing that book, but my younger brother, Peter Molly, some of his classmates were in that baby changing, baby care class. I don't know why I got off on that tangent. I wrote poems like my dad did. I went to graduate school to become a better poet. That was in Kansas in the mid 1990s. And it was in graduate school that I discovered the poetry slam, this new art form discovered, invented by Mark Smith, a Chicago construction worker. And that was the poetry slam, I thought, was the perfect marriage of my talents. I had been to drama school, but I didn't want to be an actor. And I loved writing. And now I could act out my poems and I have a competitive streak. And so for many years, I was a teacher during the week and then slam poet at night and on the weekends. And I took a team to the national championships and won in 1996 and again in 97 and took some time off and came back and won for the third time that nobody had ever done in the year 2000 and took another year off and then came back and won again for the fourth time in the year 2002. And I don't slam anymore, but I used to run a slam. And now I haven't actually been teaching since June of 2000 when I said goodbye to my sixth grade homeroom class. Although I have a master's degree in English literature, I taught math and history at another all boys school here in Manhattan, here in New York City. And that was the last time that that was the last time I taught, but of course I still teach. I just don't, I don't get my health insurance through my job. For the last 18 years, I've made a living as a poet, going around and teaching people how to write poetry, how to perform spoken word, talking to teachers. I get invited to a lot of teaching conferences and the national, the Kate conference, the Council of Teachers of English. No, that's the California Association of Teachers of English. And, education associations call me in to remind, the people like you who still do what I once only now write poems about once having done, to remind you why you chose to walk this path in the first place. And I still have to do what teachers make at virtually every reading I do, but I say it's my Jumpin' Jack Flash. And yes, I just compared myself to the Rolling Stones, but there's only one thing worse than having one poem or event, one thing you're known for that you have to do at every reading. And that's having no poems that you're known for, you know, and it would be terrible. And I know this because I've done this myself occasionally to say, okay, are there any requests? And to hear dead silent. No, no requests. Just do what you wanted to do and get off. Do you know any Dr. Seuss? Sometimes I go to a reading, like I can count on both hands, the readings that I've been to in the last, year where I have not had to write, perform what teachers make. And that's fine.
But I was reading the intro to your book and you say that that is really what transitioned you. And hearing the full story now, I mean, you had just graduated a year or so before you wrote What Teachers Make. And within a year of writing it, it was your bread and butter, may not be the right way to put it, but I mean, it was what you were known for. I mean, it spread.
Yeah, I think that's probably not, that's not an inaccurate assessment, but the timing is a little bit off. My degree in, my master's degree was 1993 from the Kansas State University. You know, I'm a New York City kid, and I went to drama school in Oxford, England, and then I was living in the Bay Area, and I spent 3 years in Kansas, and I absolutely loved it. More of America is like Kansas than is like New York.
Important lesson to learn. A very important lesson.
London. I quit teaching seven years later. Of course, I taught all through graduate school, but those were college students.
Right.
But 7 years, yeah, I wrote What Teachers Make based on an experience that happened at a New Year's Eve party in New Year's Eve of 1997. I went to this party where a lawyer sort of tried to, here's something I don't say in the poem. That poem is totally based in truth, as all my poems are based in truth, right? If I feel I need to change a few facts in order to make a more memorable poem, a more lasting piece of art, I can do that. That's what poetic license is, right? The permission to lie in the pursuit of better art. I did go to a party with my wife where I felt belittled, and this lawyer did. I don't think he said, "Be honest, Taylor, what do you make?" That's probably me, the writer, the next day, the next week, trying to figure out how I could like make myself sound so much smarter than I really am. But I do remember that his main point was anybody who would willingly choose to become a teacher in this day and age when teachers are so poorly compensated and so badly respected and revered the way they should be. Anybody who would willingly choose that as their best option in life shouldn't be allowed to be a teacher. And then he did say, as far as I remember, you know, he did ask me what my salary was. But the truth is that I looked down at my shoes and mumbled $28,500. And I did not have the comeback that became the poem, What Teachers Make. You want to know what I make? I'll tell you what I make. You know, that's the French have a saying called l'esprit d'escalier, which is the wit of the staircase. And that's basically the comeback that occurs to you as you are walking down the stairs, having been just insulted. And so I guess What Teachers Make is an example of, la poésie d'escalier, you know, the comeback, the witty response that I wish I had been smart enough to come up with.
Well, it feels like the joke is on him, because you ended up writing a poem that becomes tremendously successful, and who knows what the heck that guy's doing, but probably right. Still a lawyer. I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah. You know, the way to make lawyers feel bad is just to talk about how much you love being a teacher. Now, among ourselves, we can talk about the trials and tribulations and our greatest failures and how administrators you know, and policymakers don't back us up, and you know how educational philosophers usually have never spent a minute in the classroom themselves, but
or at least not in the last 10 years before they
wrote. Right. But yeah, me included, you know. But but if you talk about how much you love your job, And that's necessary, you know, it's also necessary among teachers. I think there's a hashtag, edujoy, edujoy, which is just, you know, let us, despite all of the challenges and despite the salary cuts and the horrible way that we're respected in society. You do need to find the joy that is in this profession. I think it's necessary. And if kids don't see that they're being taught by someone who is loving what they're doing, then you're not doing your best job as a teacher.
I agree. I think it is critical we remember those moments. I think it's important that we have those, like What Teachers Make, among others, but that you can point to and go, oh, that's right, that's why I do this. You know, and I appreciate hashtags like EduJoy and some leaders in that area where they are all about empowering teachers and reminding them about the positives. I worry sometimes that goes too far in some situations where it's then looked down upon when you say, okay, yes, I'm happy, but that doesn't mean things can't be better. And I find that sometimes, at least on the Twitterverse, that feels like you can be almost shamed for being honest about your frustration sometimes.
Shamed by the people who would rather be all EduJoy all the time?
Yeah, there's a little bit of irony in there, I feel like. But yeah, that is sometimes what it feels like.
That's funny. I thought you were going to be making the opposite point. But yeah, you can go too far in each direction. And right. I've actually been accused by someone years ago who said, stop doing what you're doing. Your poems, like What Teachers Make, are basically just trying to make teachers feel good about having chosen to do what they do. And I said, yeah, what's wrong with that? And he said, you know, there is a crisis. Our profession is not respected, and the only way it's going to get better is if there is a massive teacher shortage, and you know, it's economics, supply and demand is what's going to fix this. So stop putting a Band-Aid. Stop making us feel good about working under the conditions that we have to work under.
That feels short-sighted. You know, like that does. That's like you got to burn it to the ground before it's going to fix itself.
And also, what happens? What about the kids who are who are going to be suffering because of that massive walkout? You know, I found a letter among my grandparents' belongings that made me identify with my grandmother. This is my father's mother. And this was a letter that she had received from a registered nurse at a hospital. It was probably the 1930s or 40s. And the hospital nurses had gone on strike. And there was nobody to take care of the patients. And my grandmother and a couple of other, you know, Park Avenue ladies, decided to cross the picket lines and do what they could to take care of the sick and the needy and the dying. Because the professionals were off doing the important work of striking and trying to demand better working conditions. You know, and this letter from this nurse said, I know, Mrs. Molly, I know you think you're doing the right thing, but you are not helping our cause. You know, and she obviously kept it because the nurse was right. You know, my grandmother was essentially a scab. You know, she crossed a picket line, but she also had a big heart. And, you know, it wasn't the fault of the patients that the nurses weren't being paid what they should have been paid. And somebody needed to empty the bedpans, you know. So I can see both sides. Yeah. And I can't remember how I got into this. Oh, I know. Yeah. The most uncharitable way that you can look at what I do is I go around and I write, you know, these moving inspirational poems about once having done what people like you still do, you know? And I mean, I write more than just about teaching. I'm a father now. Right. I'm writing a manuscript called Late Father, which is about poems about my own late father, as well as becoming a father late in life. I'm 52. I'm about to be 53, and I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old. So my own mortality is even more on my mind than death would be on the mind of a normal poet. So anyway, bring us back on track here,
Brian. No, there is no track on this show, so it's totally fine. It's totally fine. It's crazy. Like you, I speak to a lot of educators. I speak to a lot of principals and administrators and people, even students and parents. And you know, my show has a lot of different guests, but poets are not normally my guests. And so your speech is more eloquent. I don't know. Eloquent's not the right word. I don't know. It's enrapturing. It's, entrancing is probably the word I'm looking for, but I don't know.
I will take all of those adjectives. Although I think what you may be hearing has more to do with the way I speak than what I'm saying.
I agree.
I'll tell you a little secret about, 15 years ago, I made a New Year's resolution to stop saying and in conversation. My brain still wants to say them, and occasionally they slip out. I've already said and several times in the 18 minutes that we've been talking, and I just said it again. But more often than not, I try. When my brain tells me that one of those little filler words, the technical word for them is disfluencies. When my brain says that now is the time that I should use one of those words, I've trained myself to instead say nothing. And that makes me sound much smarter than I actually am. And it makes me sound like I'm choosing my words carefully, which, as a matter of fact, I am. So I challenge you. Don't worry about it for the rest of this podcast.
But I was going to say, now it's all I can think about.
right.
Wow. That's already that's already useful information. Like is mine. I say like far too often, and I'm aware of it while I'm doing these podcasts quite often, but I can't always stop myself. I get excited, and then I get ahead of myself.
Right.
And that's my mouth doesn't go quite as fast as my brain sometimes.
Do you know my poem, Like Lily, Like Wilson?
I don't know.
Okay. I have a poem. Can I recite it now?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I have a poem that I wrote. This is a very old poem. It was called Like Lily, Like Wilson. I never taught an eighth grader named Lily Wilson. But on the surface, the poem was about an eighth grader who can't get through a sentence without saying the word like. But it's actually about something else, and you'll know easily what it's really about. Although some people have to listen to the poem 3 times before they realize that there's something else going on. Anyway, for reasons I'll tell you later, I'm going to try to recite the poem as I have been for the last couple of years. I've changed the title, and I now call it Like Leo, Like Wilson. I'm writing the poem that'll change the world, and it's Leo Wilson at my office door. Leo Wilson, the recovering like addict, the worst I've ever seen, so like bad that the entire eighth grade started calling him Like Leo, Like Wilson, like, until I made my classroom a like free zone, and he could not speak for days. But when he finally did, it was to say, Mr. Molly, this is so hard. Now I have to think before I say anything. Well, imagine that, Leo. It's for your own good, even if you don't like it. I'm writing the poem that'll change the world, and it's Leo Wilson at my office door. Leo is writing a paper for me about how homosexuals like shouldn't be allowed to adopt children. So I'm writing the poem that's going to change the world. And here comes Like Leo, Like Wilson at my office door. He's having trouble with his paper. He's having trouble finding sources for his paper, which is to say ones that back him up. They all seem to argue in favor of what I thought I was against. And it took 4 years of college and 3 years of graduate school and every incidental teaching experience that I have ever had to let out only, well, that's a very interesting problem, Lily. But Leo, but what do you propose to do about it? That's what I want to know. And the eighth grade mind is a beautiful thing. Like a newborn baby's face, you can often see it change before your very eyes. I can't believe I'm saying this, Mr. Molly, but I think I'd like to switch sides. And I want to tell him to do more than just believe it, but to enjoy it. That changing your mind is one of the best ways of figuring out whether or not you still have one, or even that minds are like parachutes, that it doesn't matter so much what you pack them with, so long as they open at the right time. Oh, God, Leo, I want to say you make me feel like a teacher, and who could ask to feel more than that? I want to say all of this, but I manage only, Leo, I am like so impressed with you. So I finally taught somebody something, namely how to change his mind. And I learned in the process that if I ever change the world, it's going to be one eighth grader at a time.
Wow, that's cool.
Thank you. So you understand why I changed it to like Leo, like Wilson. That now that poem is a pastiche and elision, not a word I use a whole lot, but an elision between all different types of students. The student who chose to write about gay adoption was not an eighth grader. I would never let an eighth grader write.
Yeah, about that. I was thinking the same thing. I was like, okay, I get what you're going with, but
that's a very advanced topic, Mr. Molly. She was a Kansas 19-year-old, you know, Kansas freshman, and it was the early 90s, and gay adoption was an issue back then, and I was from the Bay Area. And she, you know, chose for her research paper to write about that. And I, for once, did not let my progressive, liberal, centrist views come down on her, because that would have just made her, you know, more stubbornly entrenched in her views, which are probably just her parents' views. I just said, well, if that's what you want to write about, but remember, these are the requirements of all the sources that you quote. And she did come to my office and say, you know, I'm having trouble finding sources that back up what I thought. And I did say, what do you want to do about it? Now, if truth be told, she decided that she wanted to write in favor of gay adoption for lesbians. But gay men, she was not quite sure about yet. But you know what? I'm just going to gloss over that. We're going to celebrate this.
It's like an odd standpoint to take. I don't really know that I understand the moral ground there, but.
I wasn't going to split hairs with her. You know, we're going to celebrate the baby steps. And so because that was a young woman who wrote that poem in college, when it came time to choose the gender of, you know, so-and-so Wilson, all I really cared about was that I wanted it to, the alliteration of Lily Wilson, or it could have been Leo Wilson, because I've had just as many boys who have the like disease as I have girls. You yourself say you have the like disease pretty badly.
Yep.
And so, but I made Lily Wilson a girl because the Kansas freshman was a female. And that has inadvertently gotten that poem criticized, because it sounds like I'm shaming girls for having valley speak. And recent research shows that, you know, both boys and girls have the same speech problems that they need to conquer, but girls do get stung with the, you know, nobody talks about a valley boy. maybe a surfer dude, you know, but I was rightfully so accused of shaming young women for the way they speak. And that's not what the poem is about. So I've changed it to Leo Wilson. So that said, when this podcast is over, I know what I'm going to send you. I'm going to send you a stack of stickers that I have that say, this is a like-free zone. And I encourage you to stick them all over your
All over my laptop, office. all over my recording That's studio, right. Everywhere. That's just right. I have to remind myself. Perfect. It's interesting to me that you write a poem about someone changing their mind, and then you now, at some point later, are put in a position where you have to change your own mind about the name of a character in that poem or that part of the story. It's interesting to me. Did you have a problem with the change? Like, from an artistic standpoint, you have known this poem to be about Lily for, I assume, years, and now mm-hmm. even now you reread it and said Lily at one point.
I can't get through the poem without accidentally saying Lily somewhere in there. And in truth, I never recite it as Leo Wilson without at least first telling the story of about how it used to be Lily Wilson. The poem is over 20 years old. So it has a life of its own as Lily Wilson, but you're absolutely right. It is interesting. The poem is about somebody changing their mind. And I also have had to change my mind. I should write a little essay about that. Post it somewhere. That's a good observation. Observation.
Does it feel like a struggle for you, or is it just more of a matter of habit?
What, to put in Leo every time I say Lily?
Well, I guess, I mean, does it have value to you as Lily? Because you did not mean it as some sort of sexist attack or some sort of closed-minded view. So for you, it is Lily, it seems like. Or is it more just that you read it for 20 years as Lily, so switching now is just a challenge of habit?
That, the second.
Okay.
Switching is just a challenge of habit. Because, you know, intention is not the trump card that everybody thinks it is. If somebody says, hey, that poem is sexist, you can't say, but I didn't intend for it to be sexist, and think that that ends the argument, right? Intention, it does not, it's how something lands is especially in this day and age, how something lands in the heart of the listener. That's what's primary that here. And so were I to say, but I didn't intend for this to be sexist, and use that as my justification for continuing to recite a poem that people had said, hey, but it sure sounds like you're criticizing girls for the way they speak. Because I did not intend for this to be about shaming young women for how they speak, that made it easier for me to change. Oh my goodness, you feel insulted? Oh, then let me shame young boys. Let's have equal opportunity shaming here.
My fiance is going to make me re-listen to the last 30 seconds of this podcast over and over and over again, because that's the fight we have all the time, is I say, but I didn't mean to hurt your feelings.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid she's right. That's...
I just won't tell her about this. She doesn't listen to the podcast. She'll never know. Fine. Taylor, we've been going for 30 minutes, and I haven't gotten to any of my questions yet, which I'm so okay with. I don't even really want to interrupt the flow to ask, but I'm going to use them to continue to frame.
These are the three questions that you always ask, right?
Yeah, they're kind of my thing. So I'm going to use them to frame our continuing discussion. And
okay. And
you know, you kind of touched on a couple things I think you might use as an answer to this, and so it works out. My first question for all my guests is always, what is the biggest problem in education today?
You're asking a poet who hasn't really been in education for 18 years, and who, if teaching at an inner city public school is being on the front lines of education than I, as the product of a private school education, who, and I, this used to be my dirty little secret, I've actually never set foot inside a public school except as the guest of somebody else or as a visiting writer. I was never a certified public school teacher. I was hired by private schools because private schools can hire whomever they want to teach whatever they think they could teach, and pay them as little as they want for the most part. So it's a little bit odd. I feel out of place trying to answer that question. But I'll tell you what I think the biggest problem with education is that it's underfunded. And it has to do with the funding. The funding of education cannot be tied to property taxes the way it is now. It is underfunded. And you'll see when you get to the last chapter of my book, there is to talk about what should be happening in education is going to make the hawks call me naive. And I don't want to get into that. Nobody who has not ever taught knows how hard it is to be a teacher. Here, let me put it this way. I'm coming up with this as I, this is not how I write a poem. Everybody thinks they know what it's like to be a teacher, but nobody's willing to put in the work to actually find out what it's like. You should have to have taught for 5 years before you can, write legislation about education. The people who work next to the money somehow manage to make more of it, right? The lawyers and the bankers, when people have you by the short hairs, they can demand more of your money. But we've got your children. We are educating your children. And you can judge a society by where they spend their money. And we are our priorities are not in the right place. That was the most ineloquent answer to your question. So let's go to the next.
Actually not at all. And it's interesting because, this is episode 45 or so of my podcast, 44 maybe. And no one has that directly that I remember gone at the problem of funding. It seems to me that educator, and I'm just making an assumption based on what you've said, is you've stated that you are not qualified to give an answer. And your answer is very direct and to the point of what I think is probably possibly the biggest problem. And yet educators come at it from the perspective of educators saying that it's things like administrative support or testing or whatever they come at it from a lot of different directions. And I kind of agree with you that the root cause, the reason all those other things are problems is because they're the best we can do with the money we have in front of us. It's interesting to me that in your perspective, you're an outside perspective, basically, that you come at it from such a direct position.
So you think I would be a better Secretary of Education than Betsy DeVos?
I think my 5-year-old son has spent about as much time in kindergarten as Betsy DeVos. So in a public school, I should say. So yeah, I would vote for you.
if only the Secretary of Education was something that we all got to vote for. Senators do.
Yeah, that would be nice.
There was something I didn't take a note of what I wanted to say about education. It'll come to me. Go to your second question.
All right. Well, you're not going to like my second one either, but I'm going to do it anyways. And I'm going to go with it. What is something that you are doing that you wish all teachers would do?
Well, I want to talk about metaphor dice, my pet project, at some point.
I think we could go there now. I thought it might be a good lineup.
We probably could go there now. In 18 years of teaching poetry workshops to all kinds of students all over the world, some of whom didn't really want to be there. They didn't care that I was the cool poet from New York. And I once found myself face to face with a girl who said she was more of a math science student. And I said, well, that's okay. And I heard these words coming out of my mouth. I said, you know, a metaphor is just an equation between two words. And her eyes got big and she was like, wait, what? And I'd never thought about that way. But I said, no, it's true. A metaphor is a way of saying, let X equal Y. Let this equal that. Let this big concept that's hard to explain on its own be equal to this other thing, maybe a smaller object, so that I can talk about the object, but everybody will know I mean the concept. And she was hooked now. I said, listen to the following metaphors. My father is a gentle thunderstorm. Love is a broken pencil. Happiness. What is happiness? Happiness is a backhanded kiss. These are all following the same pattern. Concept equals adjective object. And then I said, you know, in fact, one way to write a poem, if you're ever stuck, is to just generate a whole bunch of metaphors until you find one that looks like it might be worthy of exploration, like you could apply it to your life. And then that's when it hit me that if that's such a great idea, how come nobody has invented like a game where you can just roll dice and just generate thousands and thousands of metaphors? And so that's what put me on this 2-year path to generate a game, a poetry teaching aid prompt generator called Metaphor Dice, which is, if you do run this podcast in April, it is National Poetry Month and my Kickstarter campaign is live, and you can go to Kickstarter and search Metaphor Dice and you will find it. And it's a set of 12 dice, but I mean, a full set is going to be a set of 12 dice, 4 red concepts, die, which are 6-sided. So 24 concepts, 24 adjectives, and 24 objects, which you can, you know, roll. And then you pick one of each color. You arrange it red, white, and blue. I can hear you. You've got the dice in your hands.
So I was going to say, you sent me a set of these, and they're really cool. I'm not going to lie. They're neat. And it's funny because as you were giving your examples, I happened to have those sides of the dice like up at like in front of me. And I was like, oh, that's from the example. Like, look, that's what he's doing. That's it.
Right. So, hold up. I sent you 6 die.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, you did.
Okay. And can you tell the difference? One of the die is one of our earliest prototypes, and it comes from a factory overseas. I won't say what country. And they're just gorgeous. Unfortunately, they're so gorgeous. A set of 12 dice would have been $80 retail. So we found another company in a different country, Make America Great, and they are producing the dice for us now. And that's what the Kickstarter, in fact, the Kickstarter campaign is going to be we're funding for the next iteration of the dice, which are even better than the ones you're holding, possibly even better than the first prototype. So hold up one of the red die in your hand and tell me some of the concepts that are on that one.
So I've got one of the red die here. I have I am, my birth, the mind, loving you, death is, and the heart, I think, are the 6.
Right. Now, see, those are all big concepts. They are hard to talk about. I am. I am. I am a gentle thunderstorm. I am a handed down wedding gown. Death is. Death is not going to be on the final set.
Oh, no. That's one of my rarities, my rare ones.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you've got a collector's item. I've been told that my choices for words, were quote, dark and cerebral. And I said, wait, I'm a poet. Why is that a bad thing? And so the other red one has your mother. Yeah. And your father, right? Because I wanted, you can get a lot of kids to write if you just put in your mother, you know, so they roll and they arrange red, white, and blue. Your mother is a mad blessing. What does that mean? Your mother is a mad blessing. I encourage my students to say, which is to say. And then, the shortest way to use these dice is to find a metaphor you like and then just add a line, which is to say. And then restate it artfully. So why don't go ahead and roll.
All right.
And then pick red and white and a blue.
You're going to hear all this on the podcast. There we go. All right. Well, I got your mother, so I'm going to have to keep that one, obviously.
Okay.
And then on a white dice, I have the choices of gentle and sinful. And I think sinful is probably going to be my choice.
Oh, good. Good, because that's going to be gone.
Oh, because I picked another one that's going to be gone.
I was told to stay away from, you know, there are a lot of people. There was sin. I think prayer. Did you get prayer as one of the blue dice? Your mother is a sinful prayer.
I did not. I'm going to go with wedding gown. So your mother is a sinful wedding gown, because that's appropriate. I clearly have issues with my own mother, as is evidenced here. But yeah, your mother is a sinful wedding gown. That's a.
Because I'm going to take 60 seconds and just come up with, why don't we both do it?
All right.
Why don't we both do it? Your mother is a sinful wedding gown.
Mother.
Which is to say.
Okay.
Which is to say. Okay. All right. Okay.
All right.
Your mother is a sinful wedding gown. You got something?
I actually came up with something, and it's not super negative. Okay. I'm proud of myself.
Let's hear yours.
All right. Your mother is a sinful wedding gown, which is to say that despite her glowing radiance and pristine shine, she is imperfect, tarnished, human, like everyone's mother is.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, that's...
That's great. And
that's okay.
And you know what? When I teach poetry workshops, I tell people to focus on the imperfections. Focus on the faults. The quirky faults that make us who we are. That's great. I got this. And I ended with a little bit of rhyme, which makes it sound better than it actually is. And I changed your mother to my mother, and you're allowed to do that. In fact, sometimes like eighth graders will just roll your mother is a sinful wedding gown, and they just sit there and go, no, she's not. And then one way you can use the dice is say, okay, well then tell me how the metaphor is wrong. My mother is not a sinful wedding gown. What is she? Is she a different type of wedding gown, or is she a sinful kind of something else? Okay. So my mother was a sinful wedding gown, which is to say she may have worn white, but she loved my father until she turned red all over, even in her heart, loved him like religion until death did them part.
Man, that's cool.
That's it.
That's cool. I'm gonna not geek out over the fact that Taylor Molly just wrote a poem.
I have a little bit of practice. I'm not as good with the dice as some of my friends are. And you may or may not have cut out some of the silence while you and I worked on these poems. But anyway, this all comes about because you said, what do I do that I wish all teachers did? I want metaphor dice to become so popular, to make writing poetry so easy that future historians will be able to look back at 2018 and say, what happened in 2018 that we suddenly got an explosion of kids thinking poetry is cool, or kids not graduating from high school thinking that they hate poetry? As my mentor, Billy Collins, said, high school is where poetry goes to die. So I wish all teachers had a project that they were as passionate about as I do with metaphor dice, which I hope people, all of your listeners, will go to Kickstarter, because it is active only for the month of April. Go to Kickstarter, search for metaphor dice, and back my project. We managed to get the retail price of a set of 12 dice down to $20.
Wow. That's not, you know, I have to say, and having them in my hands, I really see, and as a former English teacher who taught poetry as well, This is actually a really great tool, genuinely. You know, and I love that there's three of them. I feel like there was probably a temptation, or at least I feel like a lot of teachers would have a temptation to do two as your metaphor. You know, one is blank. And I think that this takes it so much better to have that third, that adjective in the middle to really pull you together. And I think that's great. Like, and they are like, we wrote, you know, you wrote a phenomenal poem. I wrote a halfway decent poem in like 30 seconds. And like, that's not, or a minute.
And they feel good in your hands, right?
Yeah.
My business partner is a guy named Oliver Wellington, and he is a former eighth grade student of mine from 22 years ago. How old are you, Brad?
I'm 31.
Okay. So he's just a few years older than you, but our kids are the same age. And he is a serial entrepreneur and an MBA. And whenever we meet, when there's a poem, when there's a question about poetry, like, ooh, which words should we choose to be on the dice? He says, I don't care. I don't care about that. You're the poet. You're the one who does that. And whenever there's a question about, oh, this form needs to be filed with the IRS and we need to have a P90X business license, you know.
P90X is something else. I'm pretty positive.
P90X is not the business license, I'll tell you. You know, my eyes glaze over. We're a perfect partnership because he does all the paperwork and I do all the poetry. He sold one of his companies that made an app. He had a very successful app. And so I met with him when I was trying to decide whether this would be an app or a physical set of dice. Hmm. And you know that this would be pretty cool as an app. You could roll dice. You could have just three dice on the app, but the dice, although they looked like they were six-sided, there could be 200 words
right.
on yeah. each die, right? And then your total number of unique metaphors that you could come up with would be 200 to the third power. Whereas mine is just, three to the 24th, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, it might be 24 to the third. That's what it is. 24 to the third is what, as opposed to 200 to the third. Yeah, that makes sense. And, so we were talking about it and I said, well, so what do you think? And he said, look, man, there's no question. Your eyes just lit up when you were talking about the dice and you were just sort of reluctantly enthusiastic about the app. And he's absolutely right. And I took a prototype set down to my brother's house and I was playing with my three nephews and I was talking to her, my sister-in-law, and my nephews at the time were 6, 8, and 10, and we would roll the dice and they would say, oh my goodness, love is a handed down blessing. And then they would think, which is to say, and they were competing with each other. Like who can come up with the best justification of how love is a handed down blessing? And my sister-in-law, Sarah, said, the world does not need another app. Look at this. You've got three boys gathered around the dining room table competing with each other to see who can come up with the best poetic line. The world is starved for this. So
yeah, I can see it in the classroom. Like I can imagine in the classroom having the dice and either passing them around, letting different students hold different sets of three, or doing it on like an overhead projector where they can, you know, it's projected onto the smart board or the projector and they can all see the 24, you know, the 12 different responses and make their own combinations.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea. Or you can back us by getting a teacher set, which is a set of 20 and it drops. It's pretty expensive, but I think the price drops down to 15 bucks a set if you buy 10 of them. If you have $250.
I like it. I really do. It's cool. And I will say there's an excitement to rolling dice. Like there's something like fun about rolling dice, I think. I think for everybody.
Oh, it's dangerous. You feel it's a little bit illegal, right?
Right. It's a little sinful.
It's Right. It's a simple blessing, right? What's your last question?
Yeah, I don't even care. We can go on whenever. We'll get there. So my third question, and actually before we get there, I have to go back. You mentioned that your mentor is Billy Collins, and I also geeked out for a minute because my parents gave me his book Nine Horses when I was in high school, and I've read that thing cover to cover like 20 times.
Yeah.
And that poem,
he's so good.
His poem Love, where he talks about the girl on the train with a cello, that image is always in my head. Like it's great. I just digressed because you said Billy Collins and I completely went back to think about the love poem in my head again.
Oh, wow. That's great. I'm going to go reread that.
It's so good. So my third question is, who is the best teacher you have ever had?
Dr. Joseph D'Angelo, my fifth and sixth grade English teacher, was a PhD, which is odd for a fifth grade teacher. He was an opera singer, and he was a eighth degree black belt in Taekwondo. And so he was the coolest guy we had ever been taught. And when I was teaching college freshmen in Kansas in the 1990s, I would hear myself saying things that Dr. D'Angelo had taught me. He's the guy who taught me how to write a 5-paragraph essay. The 5-paragraph essay doesn't get much respect anymore, but I'm a fan. I'm a fan. I think in terms of the 5-paragraph essay. I think it's a good way of organizing an argument, and it's a good way of teaching writing. It's a good, manageable way to teach writing. But I am blessed to have had many great teachers. And there's one thing that they all have in common. And I just wrote a poem about it. And if you want, I'll go and find that. So say something while I search my computer for this poem.
It's funny to me that you were so quickly able to come up with an answer to that question. There was just no hesitation. Whereas the other two, and especially the first one, there's so much consideration. There's everything you say is very intentional, very well thought out. And as I ask your favorite teacher, you immediately have an answer. And there's something true about that. There's something about that that is not just true for you, but true for so many people, I feel like.
I guess you're lucky when you don't have to think about that. Well, you know, it reminds me of when I do ask for requests, if I'm in a crowd where I think people know my work, I will say, does anybody have a request? And if somebody says a poem that I do have memorized off the top of my head, I like to just launch straight into the poem and just fulfill their request without talking about it. Okay. So here is, here's a poem that I wrote. I think by the time this podcast comes out, this poem might be published. Otherwise the guy who's going to publish it might have some qualms. So I tell you what, I won't tell you the title of this poem so you can't search for it.
Okay.
But here it is. Easy teachers who gave even easier tests are not the teachers I loved the best, nor those who claimed to be my friend, handing out candy like your buddy in study hall or playing kickball in the schoolyard. No, I loved the teachers who made me work hard on every paper, every sentence, project, and test. Those are the teachers I loved best. And they loved me too. Even at my worst. In fact, they likely loved me first, gave me what I needed, had my back, gently pushed it to keep me on track, sometimes cut me slack, then other times would crack their whips. Some hands need holding more than a slap on the wrist. And the twist is this: they made me whole in every place where I might have lacked. But mostly, I loved the teachers I loved because they loved me back. So that's what all of those teachers had in common. It's love. You know, I knew you will work your ass off for someone who you desperately do not want to disappoint. And so I always say that it is not important that your teachers, that you like, that your students like you. What is important is that you love them, even if you do not like them, especially if you do not like them.
Hmm. Man, I'm like, so I am just, thank you so much, Taylor. I don't even have words. I just want to end it right there because that's the best. I don't want to end this conversation. I just, oh man, Taylor, that was awesome. All of that was awesome. There's so much great stuff in there. And do not sell yourself short at all, because I know for a fact there was some phenomenal information in here for my audience to take and learn from, because there's some good stuff in there to think about in terms of, first of all, knowing that you should always love your students, but also teaching poetry and your own story tells us so much about taking what we know we can do as teachers and considering what more we can add to it as well. And I think that's an important consideration as well. So I greatly appreciate you coming on the show. I really do.
My pleasure. Thank you for having the show. It's so hard to be a teacher and do anything creative on the side. So I admire you for that. And anybody who wants to know more about me can easily follow me on Twitter at Taylor Molly. TaylorMolly.com is my website. You just have to know that Molly is spelled like the African country.
Yep.
And if you don't know how to spell that African country, I don't want you visiting my website or following me on Twitter anyway.
And of course, I will also have links to the Kickstarter in the show notes, which is, okay. I honestly, guys, I recommend it. It's neat. It's really cool. Having played with it right here, it's cool. I can definitely see my kids enjoying this. In fact, they're probably coming to school with me tomorrow so that my kids can play with it. I'm not going to lie.
Great. So thank you, Brad. Yeah,
thank you very much. Taylor, wow. Thank you so much. Even listening back to this, I'm speechless. I listened to the whole thing knowing it was fine, and I still listen to it again, which I don't usually do, and I'm just blown away by what you had to say, how much you had to bring to the show, how many great ideas you had to throw at me, and just thank you so much. It is still completely surreal to me that I wrote a poem side by side with Taylor Molly. I can't. If you want to connect with Taylor, you can connect with him on Twitter. He's just at Taylor Molly, one L in that Molly. And more importantly, check out his Kickstarter for the Metaphor Dice. The link is in the show notes. At the time I'm recording this intro, the Kickstarter has only been open for 3 days and is already over $18,000 of their $20,000 goal. So they're almost there, and that is totally awesome and justified. I highly recommend the Make a Teacher's Day a Day option, which is what I actually did myself. And it gets a set for you, and it also sends one to a lucky teacher elsewhere who can't get one for themselves. It's awesome. It's a really cool product. I'm excited about it. I don't normally promote things on the show, and I'm not getting any kind of kickback from Taylor here. But it is a really cool product, and I think your kids will like them. In fact, you can listen to the most recent episode of the Studacademy podcast that I also host with my students, where they used the Metaphor Dice to actually write their own poems on the episode. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Shuffler. I love to hear from you over there. I also now have an Instagram for the show, which is also at Brad Shuffler, or you can find me on Facebook.com/Brad Shuffler. I'm Brad Shuffler everywhere, and I'd love to connect with you in all those places. So those are also all great ways to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Until next week, I don't know, go get Metaphor Dice. I don't even have anything witty. I'm still speechless. Sorry. Taylor, you're awesome. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the Voice Ed Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. Voice Ed Radio. Your voice is right here.